welcome. It's KVC Arts, arts and entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll hear from actor and storyteller Geraldine Keams, probably best known for her role as Little Moonlight in The Outlaw Josie Wales. She stopped by KVCR to check out FNX TV, First Nations Experience. FNX started here at KVCR, so her visit gave me an opportunity to get this interview. We'll hear about The Outlaw Josie Wales and much more. That's not quite 15 minutes away. First, we have Emmanuel Rogers checking out a new book with some interesting information relative to today. We're not talking about COVID-19 or politics here. It's more about kids growing up with a phone in their hand.
Joining us today is author Caitlin Phillips. Caitlin is a journalist and editor whose work has appeared in The Establishment, Vice, Law 360, and the Columbia Journalism Review, just to name a few. Now, Caitlin is here to speak about her new book, The Future of Feeling, Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are welcome. Caitlin, now, I was reading through your book, and of course, I did have some empathy about some of the things that are going on in our lives today. In your book, The Future of Feeling, you clearly speak about how many of the technologies that we use actually stunt our emotional growth because of the lack of feeling and physical expression in conversations not conveyed in tweets, text, and other venues. How did you come to recognize this for yourself?
I've been using social media and technology for, all of my adult life and started probably when I was in middle school. But around 2014, 2015 is when I started to realize that something was not right in the way that we communicate with each other, particularly on Facebook. I, was having conversations with people, just as I had always been on these networks, about, big, important things that were happening in the world. But it seemed like in the conversations I was witnessing between other people, so people I knew and strangers, and the conversations I was having, that there just didn't seem to be room for empathy. So I noticed even with myself that, sometimes after an exchange with someone that would get heated, I would realize neither of us were really trying to consider where the other person was coming from. Not that we needed to agree with each other, but that the culture that we've built on these platforms makes it hard for us to express empathy. So I was concerned about that, and I wanted to do some research and see what the experts think might be coming next.
Okay, now I have to ask you, were the thumbs up, thumbs down just not good enough for, expressing?
I don't know that those really help you with empathy. I mean, it's interesting the way that, people, when they added the reaction emojis on Facebook, yeah, to where you can do more than thumbs up or thumbs down, you can also do a crying face or a smiley face, but sometimes even that doesn't feel like enough.
Yeah, and I noticed at one point they actually took the thumbs down out of there altogether. So you could only like it or say nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So there was nothing building there. Now, will you first share with us what good you receive from using, technology, phones, tablets, and other technologies? And then, what are some of the challenges that go with those same technologies?
Well, I think there is a level of connection that you can make with people, and I certainly have experienced that. In the book, I mentioned that while my husband and I met in person when we were teenagers, a lot of the early part of our relationship, we got to know each other by talking online, by emailing and AOL instant messaging. So I've had positive experiences for sure, because I think it kind of helps you say things or ask things that maybe you wouldn't if you were in person. But that same thing can also make it harder to understand someone else's tone. You can not realize when you've hurt someone's feelings, and it can kind of break down communication a little bit when you lose that eye contact or that tone or those in-person connections.
Yeah, now we were just glazing over this just as we started to speak, but I am so curious, as I was reading through your book, I was wondering, how does using these devices cause us to learn or unlearn how to shield or wrongly apply feelings when trying to speak to one another?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think that these technologies, you can tend to feel like you need, especially younger people, tend to get the sense that they need to present themselves in the same way that their peers are presenting themselves. So I would say that's a situation where maybe you're shielding your real feelings or emotions, or trying to put out an aesthetic that doesn't actually match what's going on in your life. But, you know, I've been encouraged to see that there are people who are creating new apps and games and technologies that encourage young people and older people alike to exercise their empathy muscles, so to speak, so that they can tap into that a little bit more, whether they're talking to people in real life or on social media.
Okay, now, before we get back to that a little bit more, Caitlin, will you take just a moment to share with our listeners where they can find your book? And I understand you have a blog also. And how can they connect with you on your blog?
Sure. So you can find everything at thefutureoffeeling.com that directs to my website, which has a link to my blog and you and my Twitter and information about the book as well.
Okay, thank you for that. Now, you were just speaking about some of the programs, and I was very interested in one of the programs that I was reading about in The Future of Feeling. You talk about a Canadian program in schools named Roots of Empathy. What is this program? What do they do? And why is it needed in today's social growth?
So Roots of Empathy, it's been going on for a while, and it is based in Canada. I think we do it in some places in the U.S. as well. And it's where a family from the neighborhood of a school will bring a new baby, you know, a baby who's a couple of months old maybe, and kind of just let, I think it's kindergartners, observe the baby and just kind of watch its facial expressions and get a sense of what it's like to be around a baby and just sort of how you're supposed to act around a small child and treat them. And the idea is that it helps pinpoint the important social and emotional skills at that age. So empathy, kindness, compassion, things like that. And they've found that in their research, the kids who go through this Roots of Empathy program, you know, do show more empathy. They're less aggressive later on, and they end up doing better in school as well. So that's something that's not tech-based, that's literal human-to-human contact.
Yeah.
But I think it's a good way to help kids learn how to access that empathy muscle in a way that they are not doing when they're learning about things through technology. So I think like a mix of these things would be great for a lot of young people to have those tech empathy experiences, but then also these real-life in-person experiences.
Yeah, you know, I found it amazing that kids were playing hide and seek online due to Mr. Gutierrez, I believe his name is, the program he was dealing with. And first thing that struck me was, how do you play hide and seek online? But then I listened to the subsequent things that you guys are talking about. Can you talk a little bit about what's lacking?
Sure. Yeah, so he was referring to a game that his son likes to play online called Minecraft. Multiple people can be playing at once. And he thought it was interesting that they would come home from school and they would log into this game and they would all play hide and seek, which normally when he was a kid, you would just do in real life.
Yeah.
So in a way, he thought that was a good thing because they have that natural instinct. But at the other end, if you're playing hide and seek in real life and you accidentally trip someone or you hurt someone's feelings, you have that immediate experience of that other person's reaction and you kind of have to imagine what it felt like for them. But online, you lose that immediate connection there.
Yeah, I mean, it really struck me because when I was a kid some years ago, I thought about some of the kids that when you play hide and seek, sometimes you might just let someone that thinks they're hiding really well just stay there while you go do something else. And I can't imagine someone just letting you do that online where you might linger and linger and not know what's going on.
Yeah, interesting.
Now, what are some of the ramifications of not teaching children empathy? And what are some of the other emotional challenges that they will face later in life's relationships?
Well, empathy has been found to be really vital in relationship building, community building, being able to take direction from people. You know, depending on the type of career you go in, it could be really important to your job. I mean, I know that as a journalist, it's important for me and the people who go into the medical field or teaching. So I think that if we want kids to have healthy relationships and do well going forward in life and also have a healthy sense of self and mental wellness, that empathy is a good thing to work on. I think that most people have the capacity for empathy. It's just a matter of knowing how to access it and to do so not only when you're face-to-face with someone, but when you're communicating online, because kids will be continuing to do that going forward.
Yeah, because, you know, as you and I speak, you can hear inflections and other things going on that have these nuances that give you some idea of how we're getting along in our conversation that you just don't get from these things. You spoke about challenges of building empathy and all. Are there other academics, counselors, and other professionals seeing the lack of empathy in youth and adults today and their effects, whether in business, school, or other places?
There are certainly, and this area of research is still pretty new. So there's not a ton of hard evidence to point to and say, because of use of technology, this is what's happening. But anecdotally, you know, this is a real experience. Doctors are definitely noticing that people are, you know, experiencing more anxiety and stress, and it's often related to the use of technology, whether for work or social reasons. Kids are experiencing similar issues in schools. I spoke to a teacher who said that her students, who I think were in fifth grade, were communicating with each other all the time via different apps and social media and text, but they weren't really saying anything. They were just doing it for the sake of doing it and not really making connections with one another. So that's definitely a concern throughout various industries, but I think that's, you know, in a way a good thing, because it means people are starting to think about what kind of correctives to put in place as we move toward the future.
This is really wild. Your book is well written, and I have learned some things, and you have reinforced some things that many of us have been seeing as technology grows. But what are some of the things we can all do to help us have a healthy relationship, growing empathy, for better interactions with others?
I think that we can all try to not respond immediately with the gut instinct if we are using social media. You know, if something upsets us or makes us angry, you know, try to just remember to access that empathy. I think we can expose ourselves more to different kinds of people who are different from us, have different experiences, by following them, not necessarily to comment, but just to observe what they're doing. And I think if you have the opportunity to do a virtual reality experience, see what it's like to kind of be someone else for a few minutes, I think it's worth a try.
Yeah, I wish we had more time to talk about that when I really enjoyed reading about the virtual reality. But I'm going to have to leave it there because our time has come to an end, but I want to thank you so much. And Caitlin.
Thank you.
No, it has been my pleasure to speak with you today. And my hope is that your book, The Future of Feeling, Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World, will open many more eyes to gains and losses that come with the use of conveniences apart from face-to-face relationships. Thank you for the book and for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Caitlin Phillips, author of The Future of Feeling, Building Empathy in a Tech-Obsessed World. Once again, more at thefutureoffeeling.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Online and on mobile devices at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. For the remainder of the show now, it's someone right out of one of my favorite movies, The Outlaw Josie Wales. Geraldine Keams played Little Moonlight, a Navajo woman who had been forced to work at a trading post, who then becomes part of a group of people accompanying Clint Eastwood's character Josie Wales on his journey. There's much more to her story, of course. She'd stopped by the studios 8 years ago, before KVC Arts had even begun as a program.
I want to talk with you about not only some of your current work, but we kind of have to go back to some of your past stuff. Let's just put it this way. I thought that your screen debut was in The Outlaw Josie Wales as Little Moonlight, but didn't you actually have a one-liner with Anthony Quinn some 5-6 years before?
Oh, you're good. Yeah, actually, that was called The City, where Anthony Quinn played a mayor of Albuquerque. I got a small role in that. That was actually my first role in any kind of production.
That was maybe a good 5-6 years before The Outlaw Josie Wales.
That's right. That's when I was actually bitten by the bug, as they say. I was at the University of New Mexico at the time, and I actually changed my major to theater because of that experience. And it was really amazing. It opened all these doors about what filmmaking was. And after that, I ended up in the University of Arizona studying theater. And that's when Outlaw Josie Wales came along later.
So you were a college student at this point, and you started to rack up some stage experience. How did you even hear about the auditions for The Outlaw Josie Wales? I mean, it was just a cattle call, right?
It was just a cattle call, and I had a friend that actually put me on board with her manager. Actually, it was like a talent agent in the city who hired a lot of extras. And so she would do that at nights or on weekends and pick up a little extra cash. And so she got me involved in that. And I was an extra in Judge Roy Bean, and I got to see Paul Newman and John Huston at work. And, you know, you're way off just being an extra, but still, it was an amazing experience. Of course, I was a student at University of Arizona, U of A, and I got called. You know, they're looking for an Indian girl that can speak her language, and if you can speak your language, go down to this place. And I get there, and there's like 300-400 girls.
Oh, my.
And that just was like just the first step in this really long series of events where I got the, well, maybe and maybe not. And then they sent everybody home. They found the girl. They flew her to Hollywood. You know, they're not looking anymore. And I went back about my business. And it was like a few months later, it was like, hey, Jerry, get down to the Doubletree Inn in Tucson. They want to see you again. I go, for what? And they go, Outlaw Josie Wales. I said, I thought they cast it. Well, this was the movie business, right?
Yeah.
So I went back, and this time they had me speak my language. At the time, Mr. Eastwood was not there. He was producer, obviously, but he sent his co-producers in. And so it was one of these hurry-up-and-wait situations where they had a room, and then I waited and waited, and finally it got dark, and they had rented a hotel room for me, and somebody came to my room, said, well, just go home, and I went home, and I thought, what's going on? And then I get home, the phone rings, and it's my agent. Get here as fast as you can, you know, and he was talking to somebody else on the phone. Oh, yeah, she'll be ready. When I walked into my agent's office, it was like he gave me a thumbs up.
Weren't you on the way there? This may have been a separate incident, but didn't your car break down? I read you were on food stamps and just, oh my gosh, then the car broke down, grease under your nails. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah, that's episode. I remember that. When they called me for that callback, it was just one of those out of the blue. I was actually a student at U of A taking stagecraft, and I had my overalls on. We were building a set. I can't remember for what play, Marco Polo or something like that.
Sure.
Everybody had their overalls and their hammers, and I had grease under my nails. And then they said, you know, you need to get down to this callback. So I drive my car, an old beat-up car, and on my way, I run out of gas. I knew a little bit about cars, so I raised the hood and tried to get it going again, and I ran out of gas, had to get the gas,
oh my gosh.
And then I finally get to the audition. So this was going to the audition for that second, third time.
Okay, so this was one of the callbacks. I was reading and watching the making of The Outlaw Josie Wales. One of the things that I saw in there was that Clint Eastwood had felt that so many portrayals of Native Americans in past movies and TV shows, they were always the stoic chief or the village elder or the brave warrior on bareback horse, you know, just fighting off the cavalry. He wanted to show American Indians, as he said, as non-Indians, that is, as real people, not just an Indian. Was this approach shared with you, what he was trying to get out of casting, say, you and Will Sampson and Chief Dan George for this motion picture, this trying to get a sense of accuracy and realism?
Clint Eastwood didn't really talk a lot. I mean, he was a man of few words, but he basically told me from day one, you know, you're here because we wanted you here, and we believe in what you bring to the table. In other words, we believe in your talent. We believe in what you do. So just do it. I mean, that was basically what he said, that they had faith in me and not to be afraid and just go and do my job. And so Fritz Maines was his co-producer. They grew up together. So Fritz Maines became like my best buddy. And he was the one that came and told me about what to do, you know, the next setup, or he would explain to me, because this was, you know, pretty big production. I mean,
sure.
It was huge. And so every little bit of it that seemed confusing, I felt very much at home in going to Fritz and asking him about what I needed to do. And so it took a couple of weeks to get the wheels turning and just being comfortable with the company and the crew and everyone. So. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned, I believe this is one of your quotes, you say that Eastwood directed the movie, but he didn't tell you how to act. He just put it in your hands.
Exactly. I would read the scene and just think about what that character would be going through and in that very moment what she would be feeling or what her reactions would be. I didn't try to think too much about it or try to play it out because that can be a mistake too. Like, one time I actually had to stab a guy, and you learn method, you study Stanislavski in college, and I had that knife in my hand for probably 3 or 4 hours practicing the scene over and over and over. Well, in the movie business, inevitably something will happen, like the sun went down. That was it, last shot of the day. We don't get to you until tomorrow. So it was one of those things I learned that no matter how much you rehearse, you may not be ready to shoot that scene. So for me, it was, I don't want to say a waste of energy, but you want to be fresh and in the moment to make that scene happen. Mm-hmm. So some people like to rehearse and rehearse and rehearse for one scene, but it turned out that I'd already done all that work from the day before. It was a little frustrating at the end of the day when it was like, that's a wrap, everybody go home. And the next day we actually shot that scene. It was funny because that scene ultimately in the end was taken out. I was supposed to stab him with a knife, and in the end I actually shot him.
I know the scene you're talking about, actually. There's another scene in The Outlaw Josie Wales. It's not long after you've been rescued, as it were, from the trading post that Little Moonlight is working at. Mm-hmm. They have you describing where you had come from. What I saw was that Eastwood told you, nobody will know what you're saying. You can speak Navajo or whatever. And when you're describing this moment, you've really got a dismissive wave of the hand. Was that scripted when your character is describing how she came to be at this trading post, etc.? Was any of that scripted, or did he just want native language? Because as he said, nobody would know.
He wanted native language. And when I talked to the co-producer, I said, I really want to do this as a Navajo girl who was captured by the Cheyenne. And this happened all the time in that time period. I had done some research. I had asked relatives and tribal historians. And it was like, yes, this could happen. And so it was plausible in that way. He wasn't really concerned with that. But Dan George was really behind me 100% because later on it called for actual line changes. You know, that Navajo girl, you know, too bad we're not going to see her again. All of a sudden you're starting to change the script where they're saying, instead of the Cheyenne girl, which is the way it was written in the script, they're saying, oh, the Navajo girl.
Okay.
And so everything had to meet up and be authentic.
Gotcha. Let me throw one more thing at you from Outlaw Josie Wales, then we'll move on from that.
Yes.
There is another moment where they're talking about how this was your first major picture.
That's right.
And during the scene where the owner of the trading post, he's beating you because I think some whiskey bottles fell or something to that effect.
Right,
so
right.
He's beating you.
Right.
You were padded all up in the back and all that so that when he's hitting you, it wouldn't hurt. And I just watched this, and I actually heard Clint Eastwood say this. You were getting hit, and it wasn't too bad. And then you're hearing him saying in the background, hit her harder, hit her harder. Can you actually bring yourself back to that time where, okay, it's not too bad, and then you hear the director, Clint Eastwood of all people, hit her harder, hit her harder?
Well, when you're plugged into a scene, you don't hear a lot of that. I just remember the paddle coming down a little harder. But later on, I saw that he had to do it a little harder to look like he was really beating me. And, you know, there was padding there, but it was a lighter pressure, and then it got to be like a harder pressure. But I've got to tell you that it really did not hurt. You know, I mean, I did not feel pain from it.
Right. So. You said that there was a funny story about your name or a bunch of names. Tell us some more about this. You wanted me to prompt you about this earlier.
Oh, yeah. Well, Geraldine, you know, everybody was telling me when I first got in the film industry, you've got to change your name to like Two Moons or you know, Sonia Running Deer, or, you know, sound very authentic and romantic and all this and that. And I go, but, you know, my own name is very interesting. Geraldine was actually given to me by a black family in Williams, Arizona, who immigrated from Mississippi during the Civil Rights era. And they came and settled in this small railroad town. And a lot of Native Americans or Navajos lived in these border towns during the Second World War. So there's a lot of history involved in this. And so she gave me her name, and she worked with my mother folding sheets at a hotel. And my last name, Keams, is actually my great-great-grandfather was from England. He was a white man and grew up in Cornwall, England, and immigrated to America to become, believe it or not, an Indian fighter. And he wanted to be in the Civil War, and that didn't work out, so he joined General Crook's army and ended up in Arizona. But he didn't like the treatment of the Americans and how they treated the Indians, so he turned around and became an interpreter. He learned like 7 or 8 Indian languages in Arizona, and he became the main liaison between the tribes and their treaty negotiations with Washington. So he became a prominent figure in the late 1800s. And he later on started a trading post, and the place name is Keams Canyon, Arizona. So it's actually pretty popular.
It's still there?
Still there.
Oh, cool.
Still there. He started a school and a boarding school and a hospital, and that's his namesake. And so I kept that name.
Oh, someday I'm going to be driving through, then I'll have my picture taken by that sign just because of this today.
Absolutely. So. It's part of our history.
Well, there's another natural segue. This is a quote. I'm not sure if it's from you or just something that you chose to include on your website, but our stories need to be heard because we hold the ancient spirit and wisdom of this land.
I think it really speaks from that fundamental self. Everybody has a core self, and you have your spirit, you have your identity, you have your true nature. And I said that because it really is true. I grew up on a Navajo reservation, and I spoke my language. I lived traditionally, taught and raised by my grandmother, and we live close to the land, to nature. We understood these stories. We heard them as children. And so when I became an adult and drama became part of my life, it was a natural segue to start learning these traditional tales and traditional stories and the meaning behind them, and to really become a wisdom keeper or a teller of stories for a new generation. So these are stories that the last generation or the generation before might have heard in the original language. And now I have to take these stories and tell them in English and then also make it entertaining enough for a TV audience. And these are kids that grow up with TV.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, short attention span.
Right.
You credit your grandmother, a rug maker and storyteller, with inspiring you to remember these stories. As a professional storyteller now, or an actress and author, take us from being in school, landing a film in an outstanding movie, or two or three or four, and then at some point finishing your BFA. How did your career flourish into what it is today? I mean, what do you say going from your grandma telling the stories into today? Is this what you saw yourself doing at some point?
Well, one of the things that I really encourage young people to do is to follow their spirit, to follow their inner voice, or to follow their dream, or to follow something that calls to them. And everyone has that voice. And sometimes we give up on our dream and we become bureaucrats or politicians. I mean, I don't know. I'm not saying that those things are bad. I'm just saying that if you have an artistic vision of any kind, which I did, I never swayed from that. I mean, it took me to get a college degree in the theater so that I could teach it one day. It took me to New York City to study professionally in the theater and understand the science of theater, the science of emotions, the science of the human being and the human nature, which is what theater and acting is all about, because you have to explore the character, you have to find the inner workings of what that makes that character be who they are so that you can give authenticity to the lines. This is the generation and the way I was taught to be authentic and what it is that you do. And so that brought me to always be available for whatever it was that was out there, whether it be theater, film, storytelling. I got involved with the Los Angeles Music Center, the Orange County Performing Arts, John F. Kennedy Performing Arts in Washington, D.C., and with all of these organizations that promoted education of children and how the arts really help them be successful students. And so the arts actually can motivate children to be good students and get them into college.
It's always the first thing to go. With more and more arts funding being stripped away, it's more and more important then for people like yourself to come in and being able to give this back, because we're not getting as much as we used to.
You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR. Back now to Geraldine Keams, though I know I did call her Jerry a few times here and there. She's probably best known for her significant role in The Outlaw Josie Wales with Clint Eastwood. There's much more to her, of course, and that's what we're talking about.
You have a children's show, Stories and Songs of My People, or is this perhaps just one working title for your presentations? Is this the actual title for a show that you tour around, or?
That's one of the main titles, and then I have another one called Legends Come Alive, which is the current show that I have been taking all over the country. I just did a week's residency in Omaha with all the native communities there. There are 15 different tribes that live in that whole region. They're also trying to explore their past and their stories. And now we have permission. I mean, at one point it was beaten out of our culture, or people were forced to become Christian or whatever. I mean, people had to give up who they are. They had to sacrifice their identity. And now all of a sudden, they have to turn that around. And, you know, it leads to a lot of frustration and broken dreams. And people have to somehow pick themselves up and begin to find and reconnect with that dream. And that's what I'm doing with this organization in Omaha right now, in that I keep going back to this community to have these young people, including their parents, get in touch with that lost dream, because it is lost right now and it needs to be reconnected. And so there are people like myself that are going in there and saying that this is fine, this is a good thing.
Is this pretty much how it all started for you? I mean, you were learning the stories from your grandma, and then were you just told at some point, you are good at relaying these stories, take this to a bigger level? How did these children's shows, is that about how that all got going?
I think that the natural progression was to make myself available, have a website, get myself on board with already established institutions like the Los Angeles Music Center, the Smithsonian, various performing arts centers throughout the country, and putting the program out there to say legends are alive and Native American storytellers are alive and the culture is not gone, it's here, it's thriving, and we need a spokesperson or we need someone to say that it's continuing and it's always been here. Hundreds of years ago, tribes had village criers who would wake everybody up in the morning and they would give the news to what was going on that day, and they'd walk around the village and they would yell out the news to the villagers. And in a way, that's my job. I'm the village crier. I'm the one out there saying, listen to your stories. If you don't have them, find them. You know, let's put this thing together and have a voice.
Nice. You've written a couple of children's books, sharing both Cherokee and Navajo stories. Now, you're Navajo. How did the Cherokee work its way in?
That's interesting, because when I was in the theater in New York City, we did a show based on Native legends. It was a beautiful, stylized theater piece. And the company consists of people from 25 different tribes or nations, and we had all come together there in New York to learn about the theater, but we also performed our own original pieces. And that development naturally involved traditional legends. And so one of the legends was Grandmother Spider Brings the Sun, which was a beautiful, wonderful Cherokee tale. And we did do that show when I was with this company in New York City. And then when I came back to the Southwest and eventually put my own one-woman show together, that was one of the stories that was right up on top, ready to go. And I did the show at a school where there was a publisher in the audience. And he fell in love with that story. And he said, I want to publish a book of that story. And so Grandmother Spider Brings the Sun became the first book that Northland Publishing published. And then the second one, Snail Girl Brings Water, which is based on the flood cycle of the Navajo creation stories. You know, a lot of these stories, hundreds and hundreds of them in the setting of the original culture, don't have beginnings, middles, or ends. So they jump around a lot, and they're not westernized. They're very organic. So I had to actually work with them so that they could have a beginning, middle, and end, and also try to have happy endings, because the westernized world likes happy endings. So it took me about 5 years to figure out Snail Girl Brings Water so that it could be told in a condensed time frame and then become a book. So that actually took the longest to become a book. But it's the nature of legends and how they work and these stories that come from the people themselves. Now, a lot of anthropologists wrote these stories down, and so a lot of people are actually going back to these stories that were written by non-Native people.
Oh, interesting.
So you have to go back and research them and then go back and find out if any Native speaker still has a connection to this particular or that particular tale.
Okay.
So there's a bit of research involved in this.
I'd say so. This is tied to my music background, that is producing music shows on public radio. A Lakota Sioux story about how the cedar flute came to be and how it ended up looking like a bird. Knowing that the cedar flute is common amongst so many tribes and nations, I'm wondering if this is a legend that actually transcends. Is this one example of a legend, like maybe the flood cycle stories, that actually a lot of different groups maybe have a version of it?
I think so. You know, for instance, the Navajos do not have a flute story.
Okay.
But they might have a love story about how you wooed the young woman, or, you know, I mean, basically that was the beginning of the original flute, was a young man trying to express his love to someone and couldn't do it through words, and so played the music and learned from the birds, and, you know, the bird coming in a dream and teaching the young boy how to make the first flute. And so it becomes a whole nother dreamlike, you know, presentation that ends up becoming a story. I mean, it becomes a legend, and then it's just passed on to the different generations and begins to live. So it's connected to love, which is very universal. Mm-hmm. And you can take it from that point to say that, you know, the first flute was made because someone was in love. And we can all relate to that.
Nice. Wow. All right. We know you, as I alluded to earlier, we know you as an author, a storyteller, or an actress. When you're away from these worlds, these entertainment-related worlds where there's people, an audience out there, what do you find yourself doing when you're away from all this, hobbies or certain compulsions that you may have? What do you find yourself doing when you're away from entertainment?
Well, I'm actually pretty much of a homebody.
Yeah.
I do needlepoint or I sew. I like spending time with my family. I love to cook. I enjoy going to farmers markets and finding food and finding people to come and share food and just very simple things. I mean, I'm not really that complicated outside of the work that I do. But my hobbies are very simple, and, you know, but I love to read. Right now, I'm reading a book called The Killing of Crazy Horse about the events leading up to, you know, his killing. And so it's very interesting to see the historical information that someone else has spent so much time researching and then writing a book about it. So I love reading. I read all the time. I mean, I might finish a book like once a week or something like that. So I enjoy historical information, and early Indian Wars is something that I'm sort of like a history buff.
Nice.
In trying to find out things like that. And right now I'm doing research on my great-great-grandfather, who was Tom Keem, who was the young man who came from Cornwall and came to this country and built a world for himself and ended up starting Keem's Canyon Community. And so one of my goals next year is to actually do a documentary about him, and I'd like the story to actually go from my search to actually go to England to discover the Keem's family that still lives. The ancestors actually still live in Cornwall, England. So I want the documentary to show me going there and discovering my English side, my English family that is alive over there now.
I think that would just be a fascinating story anyway. It's such a wonderful turnaround from this man who emigrated to be this Indian fighter and then to turn just complete turnaround. Mm-hmm. That should be a fascinating story, whether you go with the documentary version or get a fictionalized account. It's something. It's going to be a good story to tell, and I look forward to it. What are some up? This is, well, one... But some upcoming projects that we can't find out about when surfing the web or stalking the web or however you want to look at it nowadays.
Well, it's always, excuse me, you're always dreaming about something. And that tends to be the artist side of me. You're always restless. You're always looking for the next thing. You're always writing something. I've written several stories, actually dramas that I would love to produce someday. And there, you know, I have a comedy. I have one that's actually a series of stories that takes place in the 1800s on the Navajo. So it's leading up to the time of Kit Carson and the Long Walk, which is really the time when all of our people were gathered and kept in a prison for like 4 years before they were actually released. So it's our time, I think, to tell our side of the story. And I actually had this in production, pre-production with a film company at one point. But what happened was, is the producers lost, even though I was one of the co-producers on the project, what happened was they lost touch with my vision and started changing it into their vision. And they became very uncomfortable with the native side of the story. And so I began to see scenarios of the conference rooms of the military, and it became the other side of the story, which is, we hear that side all too frequently.
Oh, yeah.
And so I had to pull the project out and had to say no at that point. This happens to some of us.
Sure.
And it was unfortunate, but I didn't have the power at the time to actually turn it around to say, okay, let's do it this way, because this is the side of the story that has not been told. And I think maybe that time has come, is to try to tell 100% from the the speaker, which is the native characters and, you know, the Navajos and where they were and how they lived at the time of, you know, the Kit Carson era and what was going on before, during, and after. Because my story is about my family who actually had some members that did not get captured. So this is actually follows some of the characters that actually hid out in the canyons and couldn't even build a fire for like 4 years because they had to live undercover for that long before there was actually the Treaty of 1868 that was finally signed between the Navajos and the U.S. government. So it's bringing all of these stories to the forefront.
Nice. Speaking of which, here we are at FNX. This is something new for us. And had you heard of such a network before, something like FNX? Had you ever encountered the launching of a network like this in your past?
No, never. I have never heard. I've heard of different Indian nations having their own media center, but I don't think to the degree that this is being launched and the dream that it holds for all of our peoples in the northern and southern hemispheres. I mean, it is just an amazing task, an amazing vision and dream. And I think, though, the time has come, and that time is now. So I'm so happy that it is here.
Yeah, this is it should be quite an opportunity, not only for people, viewers, to be able to see and learn what they didn't normally have access to, but also for Native people to be able to get, as you were mentioning, get their story out, to be actually told by an Indigenous American as opposed to the Hollywood version of whatever.
And I think that in this country, people as a whole are ready to listen. Not just Native, but everyone is ready to hear this story, and now's the time to tell them and make them.
Excellent. I hope so, and this does seem to be the time. Jerry, I appreciate your time. This is longer than I had originally intended, but there was a lot of wonderful information. I loved talking to you, so I appreciate your time once again.
Well, great visiting with you, too, and thank you for having me.
It's been Conversation with Geraldine Keams to round out this edition of KVC Arts. Thanks very much to Jerry, who 8 years ago, when she came to the station, wasn't really expecting an interview. Thanks also to Emmanuel Rogers and his conversation with author Caitlin Phillips. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, and Shireen Awad. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts composed and performed by Sean Longstreet. So thanks to Sean as well. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.